to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible.
That was odd. That was odd. It wasn't our show. I was like, whoa, we're playing someone else's show. Oh my gosh. Well, welcome to another episode of, oh yeah, We the People Radio.
Yeah.
I remembered partway through. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape is located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they can take care of all your John Deere needs. Give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
There you are. Oh, my goodness. Well, that kind of threw me for a loop there. All of a sudden, I'm like, wait, what is that sound? That's not right. Oh, my goodness. Well, we are doing a part two program today. So last week we spoke with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, and we realized, well, we had a whole bunch of questions that we, you know, like things we wanted to know from her, and we realized we checked off, like, none of them. And we didn't talk about her book. There was just tons of stuff we didn't do. So we asked her if she would offer up another Sunday afternoon and hang out with us. And she graciously agreed. Gotta love her. It's October the 8th, 2023. So obviously the first show is October 1st. And I have that linked on the page today at wethepeopleradio.us. So let's tell you a little bit about Dr. Curry. She's the president and co-founder of the Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and predictions and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. Following an influential career in academic research and administration, she founded CFAN to translate cutting-edge weather and climate research into forecast products and services that support the management of weather and climate risk for public and private sector decision makers. Curry is a leading global thinker on climate change. She is frequently called upon to give U.S. congressional testimony and serve as an expert witness on matters related to weather and climate. Her influential blog, Climate Etc., addresses leading-edge and controversial topics about climate change and the science-policy interface. And that is really where the rubber meets the road, is where the science and the climate chit-chat goes. There's really quite a gap there. Her new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response and How We Can Respond, is really quite good. I've only gotten into it a little bit, but I would really encourage you to go take a look at that. So it's Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response is the name of the book. And her name is Judith Curry, C-U-R-R-Y. Her website is judithcurry.com. Super easy. Easy to remember. And we just hear so much about climate change. We are just buried in this stuff, and we pay so much money to, yeah, you know, supposedly change the weather in the future, which changes the climate on the earth and the temperature of the ocean and all these things. And I think most people go, wait a minute, can we even do that? But they can't fight back because they have no venue to do it. And meanwhile, the money is being siphoned out and delivered to the people who, I don't know, are either the true believers or the true deceivers, I guess, maybe a little of both, on this topic. So we thought it was really important to go a little farther with Dr. Curry. So good afternoon to you.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. Sorry, I had to do the long lead-in just because I think it's really important that people realize that this isn't just your opinion, that you, like, you know, like the rest of us, we look out the window and we realize, like, we've seen winter, spring, summer, fall. We've seen it snow more, snow less, rain more, rain less. And if you're, you know, as you get older, you realize, well, tornadoes are, and we've had tornadoes, we've had hurricanes, we've had, like, all these different things, and you start wondering, really? Like, in the 70s, they told us we were all going to die because we were going to freeze to death, and then it was global warming, and now it's climate change, and you start feeling like you're getting played.
Yeah, and we're still having tornadoes and hurricanes, and, you know.
So, I mean, We have opinions. You actually have facts. So we appreciate you bringing those and sharing them with us.
Well, yeah. I mean, over the many decades that I've been in this field, I've done a lot of research and I've done a lot of analysis. And many of the most consequential issues are discussed in my new book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk.
Yeah. And so do you want to start there so we don't get derailed, on all the – we can rabbit trail back to the things we spoke about before, but your book does a great job, and I would really like to promote it more because a lot of – I'm sure there's a segment of the population out there that's going, I don't know if I want to read a book about climate change. So maybe we could make this like, yes, you do want to read it, and this is why. How about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's such a, for over a decade, it's been at the top of the international agenda, climate change. And depending on which state you live in, well, if you're in California, it's also at the top of your state agenda.
And our checkbooks.
Yeah. And the concern that people have is what, they just see, day-to-day, year-to-year weather variability. They're not really, seeing anything that's particularly unusual. But what they do see is the consequences of the policies that are being put in place. I mean, with California being a notable, example in the U.S., I mean, your electricity prices and gasoline prices are hugely high. There's occasional intermittent outages. It's becoming less reliable.
Yeah, that they plan. They actually, everyone has to buy an electric car. Oh, wait, don't charge your electric car. We're not going to have power for the next. And they'll shut it off for periods of time.
Right. And this is costing people money, having to buy, induction stoves and electric vehicles and encouraged to put solar panels on their houses and on it goes. And it's really expensive. Some of these technologies are nice, but, being effectively forced to do it, isn't very good for many people who, don't have the money to do this and have other priorities.
Well, and even the solar. Like solar on your house doesn't work when there's no electricity and the sun goes down unless you have battery backup.
Exactly. You have to have battery backup. I have solar on my house and two Tesla Powerwalls. I wasn't going to do solar until I had battery backup for that reason. I was interested in doing this for energy security, not to, save a few poultry molecules of CO2 from being emitted into the atmosphere.
How dare you?
Atta girl.
So,
that's how we love
and
you.
The issue is I've gone electric in a lot of ways. We have an electric heat pump, an induction stove, and an electric vehicle. And all those use up a lot of electricity. Like in 2020, before I bought all these electric appliances, the solar panels were really covering my electricity use, and now they're covering less than half of my electricity use.
Oh, wow.
So people don't realize if everybody goes electric, we're going to have to more than double, our electricity output. And, wind and solar are just not going to cut it.
No. And would double even do it?
Well, not okay. People don't appreciate that our demand for electricity is just growing, growing, growing. And it's not just, these appliances, but all the, big data centers and artificial intelligence and blockchain use up a crazy amount of electricity. And all these have societal advantages, which I expect will grow in the coming decades. So, I think people are underestimating how much electricity we're going to need in the future. Last Christmas, there was a huge cold event in the eastern U.S., and particularly in Tennessee, and they totally underestimated the demand because they weren't aware they weren't factoring in that so many people had installed heat pumps, you know, for heating and air conditioning. And when it got really cold, it was like just a huge drain on the electricity need, and that wasn't factored into their demand. And the only thing that really saved them was nuclear power generated in Illinois that was transmitted to Tennessee. So people, you know, electric utilities just keep getting surprised by how much.
Well, look what happened in Texas when they had a freeze event, what, last year or year before, and all windmills froze.
It was in February. It was really cold,
And they were in trouble.
And one of the things that's not really appreciated, you know, when you have one of these challenging situations when it's like it's really cold, I mean, that's challenging enough as it is, but when a big part of your electricity generation is from wind and solar, then that's another big piece of uncertainty, and it just makes the grid so much harder to operate. Okay, when you have, you know, a large penetration of renewables like you do in Texas, and they came really close to a total, you know, grid blackout, which would have taken them more than a week to restore electricity, but they managed to, you know, adjust, you know, and get back their frequency control just in time. The other thing about Texas is there was maybe it was last year, a big summer heat event, and they were worried about electricity demand. And then the blockchain people said, oh, well, we'll cut back during this period. We'll cut back our electricity usage by whatever percent. I go, wait a minute. How much electricity is blockchain using in Texas? It must be a huge amount. And, you know, we're not appreciating these non sort of traditional uses of electricity when we're factoring into the supply and demand of electricity. So we're setting ourselves up for some real vulnerabilities when we get surprises.
I bet if you went out there with a handful of $100 bills and asked people to give you their top 10 uses of electricity, blockchain wouldn't even be on the list ever. You'd go back with all your money. Like, no one thinks of that. I don't believe anybody thinks of that.
No. So I followed my household electricity usage, you know, fairly closely. But you know, it's surprising what, you know, what uses a lot of electricity, and it's not always what you would think. Managing your household use of electricity, you know, is a decision that everybody, you know, makes, and they decide what they want to do. But I have to say that going all electric is really, really expensive. So, you know, combined with the money I shelled out for electric appliances and solar panels and the Tesla Powerwall, I spent a lot of money. But, well, you know, I like the new technologies, and since I'm in this field, I need to understand them and, you know, be knowledgeable about them. So that was a big motivation for my doing this, but it's really, really expensive.
Yeah, so to apply that to everybody, you look at people who live in apartments, you look at all sorts of, I mean, people who rent, you know, you go rent a townhouse or whatever. Can you imagine if they had to outfit it with all this stuff? What, I mean, it'd just be cost prohibitive. People wouldn't, you know, yes, the landlord would be the one who had to put it all in, but they're going to have to recoup the cost somehow. I don't think, and you know, the other thing too, we learned a long time ago, you know, I think you learn really, really early on in life. Somebody tells you don't put all your eggs in one basket. And even as a kid, like, you figure out, okay, I mean, you figure that out at Halloween. Figure that out at Halloween. You never carry all your candy. Because there's always some kid who's going to come and grab it all. So you make periodic trips back to the house to dump out the pillowcase so that you don't have all the candy in one bag. And so, you know, here we are all electric when we have all these other means of powering things. You know, you have natural gas. See, it's great. Like, if the power goes out and you have your stove or, you know, your heating is natural gas, you're only partly screwed. You know, you can't flip your lights on, but you can still cook stuff and you're not freezing cold. I don't know. I mean, having that variety gives us a lot, and as we innovate in one sector or another, you know, we can advance here and maybe take a little bit away from over here. But just this mandated, we were driving yesterday, drove to Sacramento and back, and Bill's like, man, I think having a Tesla car would be so stressful. You'd spend your whole time thinking about how many more miles you had to go and where your next charging station was.
And how long you got to wait to get it charged and what time you have to be there. And, I mean, there's so much, seems like to be a lot of planning involved driving one of those. Because it's not like driving by a gas station every corner, you know.
We drove 300 miles there, 300 back. And most of it is through really open country where we saw zero charging stations on our journey.
Well, California has more charging stations. Okay, I'm in Nevada. And when I drive, say, from Nevada to Colorado, I'm going through Utah and Wyoming, there are, not only are there not that many gas stations, but there are really no charging stations.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got a lot of charging stations in California compared to everywhere else in the country.
I bet, just not in far northern California. Up here, you know.
Yeah, right.
you've got a lot of open ground. I guess we have to take a break. I wasn't really paying attention, but we are tardy. Take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Judith Curry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I've done the math, calibrated the imperfections. I got my slide rule from school. You add it up, and it don't add up. Shed some light on it too. And I'm just inches close to the finish. Cross it and bid you adieu. I calculated every combination, every misdirection, every subtle deception. Kickstart my thinking, I was lost in space, staring at a spot on the moon. Negotiating the anticipation of reentering the atmosphere too soon.
People think I'm crazy, cause I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, or this world you love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now. But I don't think so, cause it's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there.
Well, we'll let Randy Newman just explain that to you. You might want to look the song up. It's an old one, but it's a good one.
You know, we had earlier mentioned the Teslas and electric vehicles. I read an article last week. There is in France, they committed a lot of money, a lot of public funds to electric vehicles and public transportation. And they had a picture of a field that had hundreds and hundreds of these electric vehicles parked. And the problem was, they introduced all these vehicles, and everybody was driving them, and it was working out real good. Well, then the batteries started wearing out, and they found out that replacing the batteries was going to cost more than the vehicles were worth. So they started parking them. And now they have hundreds of these vehicles these boneyards, unable to run them, and they are now leaking. These batteries are leaking out onto the ground, and now they've got an environmental problem with this stuff going back into the soil. So I don't know. Did you hear anything, or have you read anything about that, Dr. Cray?
I haven't. Not in France. I know that in China they have tons of abandoned electric vehicles. So nobody's really looked at the life cycle.
Yeah, and what do you do with the batteries?
Yeah. Well, presumably the battery technologies will improve, but I'm not 100% sure that electric vehicles are the way, you know, we're going to go 100% in the future. You know, if you look ahead to 2100, a really long time away, I mean, I don't see us burning oil and gas for fuel. I mean, we may use it for other things, but I don't think we're burning it for fuel. We'll probably be mostly nuclear, and in the U.S. West, I think geothermal is a good solution. Wind farms, no. But you can create synthetic fuels, liquid fuels. So, you know, I see that. I think there's still going to be a need for liquid fuels. I mean, for aviation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly not going to be batteries. It's probably not going to be nuclear powered. But I think there's a role for synthetic liquid fuels. And it may be a better solution for, like, vehicles, cars. You know, I don't know how it's going to play out. So I think sort of putting all our eggs in this electric vehicle basket isn't terribly good. I'm sure the batteries are going to improve in the coming decades, you know, and be less toxic, not as heavy. You know, we'll see what one can hope. But right now, the batteries are extremely heavy, lots of toxic stuff in them. And the mining to actually get all those minerals is, you know, people worry about, lithium is so valuable, you know, and only a few countries are mining lithium. Well, lithium's everywhere, and only a few countries mine it because you basically need tons of slave labor, and it really messes up the environment. So you only have, you know, places like Africa and China and stuff like that who are prepared to do lithium mining just because it's so toxic. So the thing about evaluating all these technologies is that people look at how much CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, and that's the main criterion. Well, it shouldn't be. You know, it should be a broader, you know, environmental issues. It should be cost, safety, reliability, the life cycle, environmental impact. You know, all these things should be evaluated rather than just, the CO2 emissions. But actually, to build an electric car, do all the mining and the construction and the steel and everything, that uses a lot of fossil fuels. And I forget how many miles you have to drive the electric vehicle to become, you know, carbon neutral. And even that depends on the source of your electricity.
I mean, that's true.
If when you plug in your car at night and the electricity is being produced by coal, I mean, you know, you're better off.
Well, like they had diesel generators behind all those Tesla chargers in California at that one big charging station,
which is just hilarious.
Right. Yeah, it's like, go across the street, and then you'll see the giant diesel generator that's powering your Tesla charging station.
Well, we're just so far from eliminating petroleum. I mean, it's petroleum is used in the manufacturing of pretty much everything, not just fuel, but the cost, if they eliminated the cost of replacing a lot of these products with non-petroleum based technology, we're not there.
We're not close to there. I mean, even just steel and cement. You know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean that uses fossil fuels and fertilizer, you know, and all these things. 50 years from now, we'll probably have better ways of doing it. But we sure as heck don't have better ways
right now.
Well, it's kind of funny. There are these things we get hooked on. Like, I remember way back, gosh, it must have been like in the 80s when I was working for Girl Scouting, and the health people got hysterical about palm oil. Oh, palm oils. You can't eat palm oils. Well, all the Girl Scout cookies that have chocolate on them, as do all the other things that have chocolate on them, are held together with palm oil. That's why it doesn't just run all over the place. Palm oil is what keeps the chocolate on the cookies. And otherwise, you just get a box with a bunch of brown, you know, schwitz in the bottom and, you know, a bunch of cookies that look dirty. It's like, yeah, you'd be pure as anything, but you'd be licking the packaging. So they wanted him to get rid of this palm oil, and they couldn't. They never could. It's so funny. I still look at packaging. Yep, palm oil, still on there. It's been keeping the chocolate on cookies since time began. And they never found a better alternative that worked. So sometimes, like the things that we want, even though that's not going to cut, well, I don't know, maybe that is the hub of climate change. It's palm oil. It's cookies. That's it. I've got to ban cookies. That's what we would do, actually, if we were going to be, you know, if we were going to think of this correctly, we would just ban all the cookies. It just seems crazy to me that we get hooked on these things, and then any idiotic answer, like, that's got to be the solution. We must get everyone to accept that. And it seems like that's what the climate, like your book starts out with, what is climate change? It's like, yeah, that's actually a pretty decent question because we're bludgeoned with it all the time. But what do they think it is? Like, what's the actual, it seems it's everything now. Everything is climate change. But what really is it?
Okay. Well, back in the day, 1970s, 1980s, when I was in graduate school, climate change was caused by many different things, geologic processes, solar variability, changes in the Earth's orbit, volcanic eruptions, you know, all sorts of processes in the oceans. And sure, humans can have an influence on the climate through land use, and through emissions, both of like greenhouse gases and also particulates, you know, like the hazy kind of stuff, pollution kind of things. So there's, you know, it's a complex mishmash of all these different processes. However, the UN has defined climate change to be only associated with human-caused emissions. Everything else is called climate variability. Now, when's the last time you heard anybody talk about climate variability?
Mostly
like
never.
They talk about climate change, and there's an implicit assumption that climate only changes, you know, from emitting fossil fuels. And I remember giving a talk. This was, I think, at a meeting of, like, related to, you know, electric utilities, owners and operators and things like that. We're talking about sea level rise. And one person says, wow, I didn't realize that sea level rise started, you know, has happened all through geologic history. I thought sea level rise only started once we were emitting fossil fuels. You know, and that's how the UN was trying to mislead you. It worked.
Exactly.
You know, natural climate variability has sort of been defined out of existence by the UN. And see, you know, I'm going to say, you know, like almost 20 years ago, the propagandists, you know, who are trying to promote action on climate change figured out that extreme weather events are going to alarm people. The slow creep of sea level rise, that's not going to alarm anyone. And Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was really a turning point because, I mean, that was, you know, just the worst disaster that had struck the U.S. in a long time. And there were some people who were saying that warming sea surface temperatures could make hurricanes more intense. So all of a sudden, people saw global warming are making hurricanes more intense, and all of a sudden people cared about global warming, so they didn't want any more Katrinas. So once you start blaming every severe weather event on global warming, or every failed crop, anything that happens in society, oh, it's global warming, and then that allows people to just shrug their shoulders and throw up their hands and
exactly.
say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's global warming. And that's really dangerous because it gives us an out, so we don't have to really look at the causes of our societal vulnerability. You know, poor land use management, poor governance, you know, crumbling infrastructure, whatever. I mean, it gives us an out from confronting our real problems. Oh, it's just climate change. And, you know, in order to fix it, we have to stop using fossil fuels. And what these people don't realize is that even if we were, if we did manage to get to net zero by 2050, which is, as far as I can tell, an impossibility, we wouldn't notice any change in the weather or climate. We might start to notice something in the 22nd century. I mean, we've always had extreme weather events. We have them now. We'll have them in the future.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, none of that's going to go away. And even with sea level rise, I mean, that doesn't turn on a dime. I mean, it takes centuries to sort of, there's so much inertia in the oceans and the ice sheets. Like, none of that's going to turn on a dime. So.
Yeah, the idea that we can control the temperature of the entire ocean. It's like,
well, the idea.
Okay.
How about?
That's just kooky.
You know, the climate is going to be unlivable in, what was it, 12 years?
Well, I think that's this year, isn't it?
Yeah, we're getting awful close to that.
Well, you know, the crazy thing, you know, like the one impact of a warmer climate is more frequent heat waves, or at least more intense, depending on how you're going to define them. But in terms of overall mortality, almost an order of magnitude more people die from cold extremes than they do heat extremes.
Exactly.
And this has been shown all over the world in many, many studies, so it's not just the U.S. or whatever. I mean, extreme cold events are more lethal than heat events. So if we're increasing our heat events, but decreasing the cold events, that's overall going to reduce mortality from temperature extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which is a good thing.
but that isn't how it is portrayed.
It's not.
All this is coming for you like a giant monster, and then they can come up with all these crazy things that you have to do in order to mitigate for the thing that isn't even a thing, but nobody asks, is it a thing? Right? They get all tangled up in the mitigation, and nobody says, should we mitigate?
Yeah, it's been like that from the very beginning. I mean, you have to go, you know, in 1992, we had the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change put forward a treaty to prevent dangerous anthropogenic climate change through eliminating fossil fuel emissions. I mean, this was in 1992, before there was even any evidence of warming or that it was dangerous. We understood nothing. But they had the policy objective in place. I mean, this, you know, was an environmentalist agenda, an anti-capitalist agenda. You know, we hate the oil companies agenda. It was a non-governmental world control agenda. And a population control agenda.
I mean, I think we would be remiss to leave that out.
Sure. So this was, you know, the agenda. And so the focus was on dangerous human-caused climate change. And so we're all chasing that down. I mean, nobody's talking about natural climate variability. And nobody's talking about
benefits. We can all see out the window.
Right. Exactly. And nobody's talking about the benefits of a warmer climate. If you're living in Canada or Russia or northern China, I mean, a warmer climate.
Yeah,
probably.
They pray for that.
They'd be super excited about that, actually. Well, it's kind of funny, I guess, in my, you know, if I was going to condense it down and like in my mind and I sort of look at it in fast forward or like the 30,000 foot view, I think, let's see. They were hysterical. We were all going to die from eating palm oil. So we had to, you know, bludgeon the Girl Scouts to change their cookie recipe. But the thing that's funny is they're still eating it. It's 2023. Girl Scouts are still selling cookies and nobody's dead yet. So, and they gave up. They're not talking about it anymore. And I thought, you know what? Maybe the name of the game is outlast them. Eat your Wheaties and live longer. You can watch them just fade away and come up with some other nonsense, because there's more nonsense coming, I'm sure. There just seems to be like the Department of Nonsense that churns this stuff out secretly. And there's a group buying it every minute. We got to take a really quick break, though. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. We love her. Our time always goes too fast with her because we talk too much. Sorry. We'll be right back.
Who's to say I can't do everything? Well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. Oh, what I would do to have the kind of strength it takes to stand before a giant. With just a sling and a stone, surrounded by the sound of a thousand warriors, shaking in their armor, wishing they'd have had the strength to stand. But the giant's calling out my name and he laughs at me, reminding me of all the times I tried before and failed. The giant keeps on telling me time and time again, boy, you'll never win. You'll never win. But the voice of truth tells me a different story. The voice of truth says do not be afraid. And the voice of truth says this is for my glory. Out of all the voices calling, choose to listen and believe the voice of truth. The stone was just the right
thing. Yeah, I think that's, I think Casting Crowns has it right. The voice of truth is sometimes hard to find, sometimes hard to discern, but once you hear it, you recognize it. Like the things that you tell us, Dr. Curry, about all of this climate change and all the policy goals and the stuff, it resonates because you realize that actually makes sense. You hear the other stuff and you go, what? You can't help it. So tell us this, like I'm actually just looking at the index in your book, and I understand why you did it the way you did, because it's for us regular people. So it starts out with what is climate change, but then you move into what do we know with confidence? So what do we know that's actually true? And when we hear deviations from that, we should know they're kind of coloring outside the lines.
Okay. Well, global temperature has been increasing since about 1860. Nobody questions that. We disagree about the magnitude, and the data is never perfect, but we know which direction it's been going. We know that humans emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Nobody questions that. Carbon dioxide has an infrared emission spectra, which means that that's sort of like a fancy couple of words. It helps keep the Earth's heat, in the Earth's system rather than just radiating out to space. Nobody disagrees on those three things. But the most consequential issues, there's substantial disagreement on. I mean, how much warming is caused by this additional CO2, and is it larger than natural climate variability? There's disagreement on that. How is the climate of the 21st century going to play out? There's a huge amount of uncertainty on that one. Warming dangerous? Well, this is the weakest part of the argument. There's a lot of disagreement as to whether overall warming of the planet is dangerous. And finally, there's huge disagreement about whether rapidly reducing our emissions of CO2 is going to make humans better off now and in the future. So the most consequential issues, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of disagreement.
Which makes it difficult for the people raising questions, because the narrative has always been about, I forget, 95% of the
scientists.
Is it 97% of all the scientists agree? And it's like, okay, you can't get 90% of anything to agree on anything. That's just silly.
Well, they agree on those first three points about the warming atmosphere and CO2 emissions and the infrared emission spectra. I mean, everybody agrees on that. But they've tried to parlay this into, well, through consensus entrepreneurship, to extending this consensus on these basic facts to go way beyond.
Right. That 97% of them agree we need to, you know, destroy modern civilization in order to save the planet.
Okay. Well, this is the scary part.
Scarier than that?
Well,
just kidding.
You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you know, a lot of activists said, oh, wow, I'm really interested in this issue. And they went and got their PhD, and now they're predominant in the university. There was a recent survey of U.S. university climate researchers, and something like 70% of them favored degrowth, not just green growth, but actual degrowth. You know, they want, you know, fewer people. They want us to consume less. They want us to lose fossil fuels. And that's a scary high number. I mean, like, what are the, you know, there's really two fundamentally different worldviews. Well, there's many permutations, but there's one that, you know, views humans as a blight on the planet. And, you know, just wishes we weren't here. And then there's another one who, on the other side, you take humans for granted, you know, at the top of the heap, you know, and how can we thrive as humans, you know, on this earth? And we do understand that we can't totally trash the earth if we're going to live here comfortably, but it's really more of a human-centric, you know, view on the world and the climate. So, I mean, that's just two fundamentally different worldviews, and I don't know what personality traits or cultural factors or educational issues contribute to why you end up with one or the other worldviews, but that's really what's at the heart of the conflict over this issue. People who just want humans and modern society to go away. And the others who want humans to thrive and flourish, and the more the better.
Well, but the funny part is that first group, like, the thing that you figure out right away is they want other humans to go away and other people's creature comforts to go away and other, like, not their own. Like, those are the people who are flying in private jets to the climate conference.
Exactly, exactly. So it's massive hypocrisy. So I don't know how they deal with that cognitive dissonance in their own heads.
I think it's
really
called lying.
Yeah.
We also learned that when we were children. I think our parents busted us on that one. It involves soap in your mouth, I believe. Yeah. You know.
Well, I think another thing they don't really consider, or maybe they do, is a lot of this climate change is really kind of cherry-picked. I mean, the Earth is a huge ecosystem, and to go around and pick certain regions that have their climate is changing doesn't mean the entire system is in danger. And I think that's the way they're treating it, is, you know, the Earth is going to be unlivable. Well, certain areas, I mean, look at some of the deserts on our planet that didn't used to be deserts. You know, I mean, it's an ebb and flow kind of a thing. But to think that human beings can change that, can stop that from happening, it's that we can't. We can't stop that. I mean, things are going
to
change.
Have you ever tried to eradicate weeds in your yard? I mean, even just the weeds in your yard, we can't control that. And I'm like, when you can have a weed-free lawn, give me a call and we'll put you in charge of the world. But until then, you're just a regular person like the rest of us.
Well, you know, this goes back to the whole UN agenda. You know, they define this climate change to be irreducibly global, and therefore the solution had to be global, you know, and this leads
right.
us to the that we're currently in. But, you know, climate is local. You know, they're in the U.S., there's like in the southeast U.S., they haven't really been warming at all, you know, so...
Well,
know,
that's what I mean. Yeah,
time.
it's very regional. I mean, it just depends on where
sure.
you look.
And then certainly in the western U.S., well, most of the U.S., the 1930s were the period with the worst weather, the worst heat waves, the worst droughts, forest fires, even the worst U.S. landfalling hurricanes. So, you know, there's a lot of regionality to climate and extreme weather. So, you know, and then they cherry pick each extreme event, you know, wherever it happens over the world. Oh, it's global warming. But, you know, the bottom line is that it's the large scale ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns that conspire to give us extreme weather events. You know, it's
how about
not
the
CO2.
Sun? And how about the sun? I mean, the sun's a major driver of all of this.
Oh, sure. You know, the sun. Well, one of the issues is that the sun has been marginalized in all this, and because the focus is dangerous, human-caused climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So the sun has been rather marginalized. I mean, we had a grand solar maximum in the late 20th century, and the effect of that on warming the climate is dismissed, all but dismissed. Okay, and, you know, it just makes no sense. So we haven't adequately investigated the solar influences on the recent climate. And there's a lot of indirect solar effects that aren't sufficiently well understood. So I think there's plenty that we don't know about the sun influences on the climate. But even what we do know, well, there is disagreement, but, I mean, it's almost certainly bigger than what the UN climate assessments are telling us.
Oh, yeah, because it was, it's been quite a few years ago, but we had Dr. Willie Soon on.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he's the sun guy. And
yeah.
just the things that he listed, I was like, oh, for heaven's sakes. You never hear any of those things. You never hear anything about the sun
it's
in this debate.
Because it goes against the...
Well, it blows the orthodoxy out of the
exactly.
water. And the great part of it... What a bonus. Nobody knows anything about the sun. So if you don't talk about it, nobody goes, hey, what about the sun? Like, right? It's just the thing we don't talk about.
Yeah, I mean, and we're fooling ourselves. You know, there could be real surprises in store.
That we would be totally unprepared for, because unlike the companies that you advise, on weather and prediction and all those things, you're helping them prepare for the future. The bad part is we as a global society, doesn't matter really what facet of it you look at, they're not making those plans. I mean, we're not sober decision makers there.
Right. I mean, we could really be surprised. And this is what part two of my book goes into, you know, how might we be surprised by how climate plays out in the 20th century. The sun is one issue, but volcanic eruptions, for the last 150 years, the volcanoes have really been very quiet. I mean, we've had a few notable ones, but overall they've been very quiet. But in the first half of the 1800s, not all that long ago, we had three massively explosive eruptions, including Tambora. It was a year without a summer. I mean, and global temperatures drop like a degree Fahrenheit for a couple of decades because of these volcanic eruptions. And all of the, and it, you know, reflected all of the sulfate that goes into the atmosphere, reflected a lot of sun, which was really bad for crops. you know, which led to, you know, famines and whatever. And, you know, people just, you know, assume, well, even the UN climate assessment assumes that volcanoes will be pretty much like they
volcanoes
were for
are
the
no
last
big thing.
100 years.
Let's talk about that when we come back on the backside of the news. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pappe Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they've got everything John Deere up there. If you need a tractor, you need implements, you need mowers, you need zero turns, they've got them all in stock right now. Go up and see them. Their inventory is really good. They've got full parts and service. If you need something repaired, they can jump on that right now. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also
get them on the web at pappemachinery.com.
.com. Ta-da. That's right.
So today is October the 8th. This is a continuation, kind of our program with Dr. Judith Curry from October 1st, 2023, in case we replay this on a different time in the year, because this is really basically timeless. I don't see the climate change people getting religion any day soon and figuring out that a lot of what they're pumping is silly. And I don't necessarily see the return to science coming. But, you know, things always do change. So who knows? Maybe scientists that actually do real science will be popular again in my dreams. She has written a book. It's called Climate, Uncertainty, and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. I saw it on YouTube, so it must be true. Someone said she's a climate heretic, which I was like, well, she's our new best friend. She must be awesome and amazing. She was a climate denier, something or other. We're climate deniers. She had a better title. She has a PhD, so, you know, when you're a doctor, you get a better heretic name than we do. I forget. She is the co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. Her website is judithcurry.com. And I would really, really encourage you to go take a look. She's got great information there. And cfanclimate.net is her company, cfanclimate.net. And we've got all the book and everything linked up for you on the website. I was looking at so before I forget, what kind of a heretic are you, Dr. Curry? You're a climate – it was long. It's kind of a – title.
This is going to be in 2010.
Okay.
The Scientific American published an article. They did a pretty big interview with me, and I got, you know, all my points across, and they had this photo shoot and a makeup artist and the whole works. I said, okay, wow, you know, I'm really glad that I can get my perspective out there. So what do they title the article? Judith Curry, Climate Heretic, Turns on Her Colleagues.
Oh, nice. My God. And for that, you needed a makeup artist.
Right. Well, I think the author might have been more well-meaning than the editor.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That happens sometimes.
Okay. But
wow.
Basically, this was following, I don't know if you've heard of Climate Gate, which was the emails. Yeah, okay, you've heard of that. Well, this was following that. What I had done is I had called out, you know, these scientists in a gentle way and say, look, you need to be more transparent about your methods. You need to make your data publicly available. You need to be more honest about uncertainties, and you need to lose that overconfidence. It isn't scientific. And finally, you need to be respectful of the people that disagree with you, particularly when they're research scientists who have different perspectives or you know, new evidence. You know, you shouldn't just try to cancel them and insult them. So, you know, that sounds like motherhood and apple pie, but boy, was the climate establishment upset with me.
Oh, yeah, because all those things are super unpopular. I know that.
I mean, I dare to criticize the IPCC, you know, the UN climate assessment and all these important people, you know, and, you know, and wasn't, you know, so people, you know, didn't know how to deal with me. Okay.
Get rid of her. That's always how they do it, isn't it? Like, make you shut up. Isn't that the...
Well, they called me, you know, then they say, okay, well, let's just call her a denier.
Name caller. I forgot about that.
Yeah, throw her into the camp of crazies, and then we can just, oh, she's a denier. We don't have to listen to anything she says. So they tried that. I don't think it worked too well because, you know, my science remains very sound and fairly prolific.
Well, facts are stubborn things, you know. I mean, when you run around and write a book like Al Gore did, and every single thing in the book didn't happen. You know, facts, even though he wrote a book and flew all over the world and tried to make everybody believe him, still didn't make it true.
Yeah, that's true. You know, so it's not about science. It's about the social aspects of science. You know, who's important, whose voice is heard, who gets the media attention, who gets the grant money. You know, so forth and so on. Not about the real scientific arguments or evidence.
Not about getting to the bottom of the issue. It's a little bit like bad policing, right? They decide who did it and then make all the investigation make that person guilty, but never really look for who did the crime. I mean, I think everyone would agree that's a terrible way to solve. Yes, someone went to jail, but was that the right someone? This is just the really, really big version of trying to solve a mystery, and they've decided, you know, who the criminal is, CO2, and, well, it's us, really. I'm lying. It's us, and we're using CO2 to destroy the world.
Well, it's even worse than that. They decided on the punishment.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that.
You know, get rid of the fossil fuels before they even really figured out the
That's
crime.
Right. They strapped us to the electric chair before they laid out the charges. I forgot about
that. Right.
Literally, the electric chair. Huh. Interesting. We should bring that back. So your part two, the uncertainty part. I like your title, the climate change uncertainty monster. So what's hiding under the bed with the uncertainty monster?
Okay, well, this comes from the idea of the monster. It's the interface between society and technology. It's a Dutch philosopher who came up with this sort of monster framework. Okay, and so then there was another Dutch social scientist who took it to the monster at the interface between science and policy, you know, where facts versus values, you know, how to communicate it, fear versus opportunity, and all these different dichotomies. And so I said, climate science uncertainty monster, you know, that this is my little theme here. And it's really about how we have monster coping. Okay. So a couple ways you can deal with the uncertainty monster. You know, you can try to hide it. Okay. And this is like an example of this is, you know, Michael Mann and his hockey stick, you know, trying to, you know, hide the uncertainties and squash anybody who talks about them. You know, then you have...
That really worked well.
I mean,
you got to hand it to the guy. That was a pretty quality plan.
Yeah.
They're still clubbing us with it.
Yeah, and then you have monster simplification, where you get a bunch of experts in the room, and they manufacture a consensus, and this is what the experts say. Okay, so that's sort of...
That is kind of a good point.
You know, that's another thing that we see. And then uncertainty monster elimination, and this is like, well, more research and we can get rid of the uncertainties. Well, when you have a hugely complex system like the climate system, well, we do more research and we just figure out more things that we don't know. I mean, we do increase our knowledge base, but the things that we don't know, you know, the world of that becomes even larger. Then you have monster detection. You know, you're trying to figure out what we don't know, you know, what the uncertainties are. And, well, and that's sort of what my book is about, is sort of like a monster detection thing. And the other thing is monster assimilation. It's just saying, okay, there's a lot of things that we don't know, and many
friends
of these things that we can't know. Okay, so now what are we going to do? You know, so, and this is sort of the risk and response section of my book, which talks about, you know, how we assess risk and how we can manage them and how we make decisions under conditions of deep uncertainty. So that's the sort of the third part of the book is really monster assimilation, if you will, into, you know, we have to, you know, we need to abandon the idea that we can control pandemics or that we can control the climate. Instead, we need to work to understand and then figure out how to manage the impacts. And in a way that, you know, is we have low regrets in terms of what we do. I mean, this whole net zero thing is something that is what I would say a non-robust decision, because if it turns out that human-caused climate change is not much of a problem, you know, we've destroyed our economy and spent a lot of money on wasteful things, and we could have been dealing with real problems. So that's the uncertainty monster, and it sort of pervades parts two and parts three of my book.
Yeah, yeah, we've more or less put the response ahead of the horse.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, anybody who's, you know, fixed anything or remodeled. I mean, remodeling is a good example. We remodeled a house, and we got to this one part, and they had paneled the living room. They had changed around, you know, the structure. The front door was no longer where the front door was. And where the old front door was, there was a paneled over, you know, the whole room had been paneled over. Then they painted over it, so you didn't really notice it was paneling at first. Then we started looking at it, and it's like, wait a second. That other room has a part of the wall that's like pushes into the room. So there should be a space on the other side, but it's flat. Like, wait a second. There's like a room. They've paneled over a space. And so it's like, well, we got to cut that open. And so Bill and I like went back and forth. Bill's like, we're not cutting that open. And I go, I'm not living in a house where I have a whole big space in there and I don't know what's in it. Like, I want to know what's in it. Bill's like, what if we cut it open and it's like a dead body or something? I'm like, I don't know, but I'm cutting it open. We got to cut it open. And so we went back and forth on this thing. Like, do we leave it alone, right? Do we just paint the room and just go about our lives? Or do we need to know what's in the space? Well, you know how that worked out. We cut it open. But it's really weird. Like, there is nothing that you do in this life, including raising children, raising dogs. Everything has uncertainty to it. And you cannot, it's impossible to go through your life and not address it. Like you have to
acknowledge it, and, you know, and people figure out how to manage little risks, you know, about being careful when you cross the street, or the more mundane risks. And this leads us to figure out, you know, how to deal with bigger risks. But when you have like these real complex system, I call them wicked problems, you know, the economy, pandemics,
yeah,
you know, climate
things,
change, all those kind of stuff, like you can't control. We just need to abandon the idea that we can control. That's one of the key messages from my book. But there's still a lot that you can do, you know, to make us less vulnerable to whatever might happen, be it with pandemics or climate change or the economy. And so we have to figure out, you know, how to reduce our vulnerability and make smart decisions that are adaptable. You know, as we learn more, as conditions change, we need to be able to adapt and change our response, you know, and as new technologies become available, new information becomes available, we need to be able to be flexible. I mean, you know, and all of this sounds like common sense.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, gee, what's up with that?
Yeah.
More heresy, I'm sure.
Yeah, common sense is very uncommon when it comes to these kind of problems because people want power and control. And, you know, they seize on these issues as a way to achieve those objectives. And that gets us into a lot of trouble.
Well, but you know, even like in my remodeling problem, you couldn't just ignore. You had to go one way or the other. You always have to go one way or the other.
And I think it's important.
And with this, to just pretend that there is only one way is just not.
Let me defy logic. You can hedge. First, you could have got maybe some sort of X-ray machine to try to see what's in there, thermal imager, see what's going on. You could have maybe drilled a little hole and try to look in and see what's going on. So there's some incremental things that you could have done.
Of course.
To try to figure out what's going on before you took the big jump.
But you still had to put your foot in it, you know, you still had to go.
Right, you had to take a baby step. So,
yeah.
So this is my point, is to start with baby steps.
Yeah, you don't have to change the 100% of the course, but to not even acknowledge that there's, you know, that the road less traveled, there's never one way to do anything, really.
Right. What you do is you look for the win-win situations. Okay, in the climb arena, and this takes us into part three of my book, I mean, find the common ground. Nobody disagrees about doing more research and development for better energy technologies. I mean, of course we want something better than what we have, you know, by the time we get to the late 21st century. Nobody disagrees on that. Nobody disagrees that we're too vulnerable to extreme weather events and that we should figure out ways to reduce our vulnerability through infrastructure, through better emergency management, to whatever. I mean, so there's things that people can agree on. Okay, focusing on solutions or policies that make sense, then that sort of bypasses the whole issue of what's causing climate change. We don't need to agree on that before we do sensible things like R&D for energy technologies and reducing our vulnerability to extreme weather events. I mean, these are things that make sense. So that's an example. And the bad thing is that focusing on climate change has distracted from dealing with real environmental problems, you know, like pollutions and habitats and species. And, you know, a lot of what we're doing with wind and solar is just terrible for the environment.
Yeah, it's impacted. These one-way solutions have really impacted the things they claim to care about.
I know. You know, in the 1970s, you know, when Greenpeace was just getting started, their big cause was save the whales.
Yep.
Okay. And now look what's going on off the mid-Atlantic coast. We've got all these whales dying because of the sonar and all the crazy activity going on offshore to install offshore wind, which is a totally bad, not too expensive, not to mention insanely expensive solution that just simply is not going to work for a whole host of reasons. And in the meantime, we're killing hundreds of whales. And Greenpeace, you know, is completely mum.
Nowhere to be found. Me. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're going to set up another date with Dr. Patrick Moore, who started Greenpeace and then left. And I remember back when we spoke with him years ago that he said that the reason that he left was because they were they wanted to ban chlorine, and he was like, "All right, that's it, I'm out." They were just fundamentally unserious. Gotta take a quick break. We're gonna come back. I forgot we had to take a break. I thought we already did it. Gosh, time flies. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. How much fun would it be the next time the IPCC meets, you just like slide that in and it starts blasting out of all the speakers? Who made you king of anything?
Let me hold your crown.
So Dr. Curry, on the risk side of the climate debate, I mean, that's a huge list. It's got to be a huge list. What's at the top for you? Like, I guess it depends on who's asking.
In terms of what's the worst thing that might happen?
Maybe. I guess if you had to put it in some sort of like crazy order, is there such a thing?
Okay. The worst thing that could happen,
yes, there is such a thing,
is a partial collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Okay. The West Antarctic ice sheet is unstable. If you took away the ice sheet, you know, the continent would actually be well under sea level. Okay, so it's a hugely thick ice sheet. And because it's grounded below sea level, it's unstable and it moves fairly fast.
Yeah, because it's like miles thick, isn't it?
Yeah. And so there's, whenever you hear, oh my gosh, an iceberg the size of Rhode Island just broke off. Well, that's usually coming from the West Antarctic ice sheet. And it's not an uncommon occurrence. I mean, these big icebergs, ice islands even, you know, just leave the continent, you know, with some regularity. The question is, well, is global warming making this worse? Well, conceivably a little bit, but it's really, if this were to collapse, it's more likely to be, you know, associated with geologic processes. There's a lot of geothermal heat and even volcanoes beneath parts of the West Antarctic ice sheet. If that was to become more active, that would make it more unstable. There's also the ground beneath is rising. Something that's not quite understood is to why it should be rising so fast, and so that colors our perception of instability. But when people talk about tipping points or something really crazy and bad that could happen, that's probably at the top of the list. It'd be collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which would raise sea level by a few meters over the course of a couple of centuries. So that's probably the worst that can happen. But in all honesty, natural climate variability and geologic processes are more likely as a potential cause than global warming. After that, you know, I don't see a heck of a lot to be concerned about. You know, the past 150 years have seen really quite benign weather. I mean, you know, people, our climate is, you know, and all the warming, you know, the 2-degree target and all that kind of stuff that the UN folks talk about, that's relative to pre-industrial, you know, about 1750. Well, the 18th century, the 1700s, were a terrible time. I mean, it was towards the end of the Little Ice Age, which was the coldest period of the past 1,000 years. I mean, think George Washington at Valley Forge, Mm-hmm. That was, you know,
never
really
talk about
cold.
The food or the weather.
Right. And in Europe in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, the weather was just so bad, so cold. There were famines and just, you know, it was just horrible. And they were drowning witches because they were blaming them for bad weather, you know, in the same way that now we blame fossil fuels for bad
right.
weather.
But the bad weather back then had nothing to do with human caused.
Oh, no, it was cold.
They were driving their wagons too fast.
Right. But my point is that the weather tends to be much worse when it's cold.
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and so they reference the current warming to this very cold period. Well, you know, like it was some sort of Goldilocks climate, you know, back in the 1700s. Well, it certainly wasn't. So it's just another sort of nonsensical thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like if we pass 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, it's the end of the world.
I don't want to zoom by that. Wait, is that why they think, is that, apparently I don't study this enough. That's the frame of reference. They think everything was so great then.
Yeah, pre-industrial, before humans started influencing the climate.
And so, we've got to get back to that because it was so fantastic.
Well, I don't think.
How do you make a serious argument about that?
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy, but it becomes enshrined in.
You've got to fly to a foreign. You got to fly to a foreign country on a private jet, sit around with a bunch of people who only think like you. I guess.
Yeah, it's not quite. And you know, it's political. And people say, "Oh, well, it's science tells us what this target is." It does. The science has had nothing to do with it. This was purely a political decision.
Poor science gets blamed for everything.
You know, these targets to maximize the pressure. If the target's too high, well, people say, "Oh, later." And if the target's too low, it looks hopeless. So it's carefully calculated to maximize the pressure for action. I mean, it's totally a political decision.
Wow. It's as random as it feels.
So there really is, I mean, if you were to sit down with them and say, okay, pick a time period that was the perfect climate and we'll shoot for that, what would that time period be?
Well, again, climate is regional.
Yeah.
So, yeah, where are you? And how do you make that be the whole world?
Exactly. So it's, you know, with any climate change, there's winners and losers. But why do people think warming's bad? You know, in the U.S., I mean, people are migrating from Illinois and New York to Florida and Texas and Arizona because they hate cold winters. What's wrong with a warmer climate? But then you talk about, well, you know, in the Middle East, oh my gosh, it got to some crazy temperature. Well, they know the temperature's really hot there, and in the wealthier countries, they're wealthy because they have a lot of oil money. I mean, everything's mm-hmm. air conditioned, and they do just fine.
Yeah.
You know, and people work at night. A lot of, you know, a lot of athletics and work, outside work, occurs at night when it's cooler. I mean, they've just adjusted their schedule, you know, around that. So, I mean, this is the weakest part of their argument, that sort of warming is dangerous. And if you take the extreme weather events out of the equation, which have little to anything, to nothing to do with warming temperatures, you know, you're just left with the slow creep of sea level rise and some glacier melting, and it's hard to make that sound very dangerous.
Right. Well, I remember when Dr. Moore spoke about the bleaching of the coral reefs and kind of, I'll tell him I said this, but he went a little crazy. He started kind of ranting, and he's like, that's just ridiculous. You can't bleach a coral reef. I mean, he's like, it's the plankton. And he kind of went into what makes the color on the reef. He's like, coral doesn't have color. Like, oh, I guess, I mean, I didn't think it was really happening, but after he explained it, it really wasn't happening. And I felt bad for him. I'm like, scientists must be so frustrated right now.
corals are a dynamic ecosystem. They have natural die-off and they have natural periods where they thrive. And most of the publicity has been about the coral reefs off Australia. Well, right now they seem to be doing fine.
Oops.
A couple of years ago they weren't doing.
Let's not talk about that right
now. Yeah. Wait. That doesn't feed into the more bad news scenario. That's a funny part. Like things that do well, it's like shh. That's not a thing today.
Oh, exactly. They cherry pick to only talk about the bad things. I mean, so have you ever heard that extreme cold events cause 9 times more deaths than extreme heat events?
No.
I haven't heard that, but I did grow up in Connecticut, and so I am aware that, you know, winter is a little little tougher. Just if you're going to look from a kid's perspective, like getting to school in the winter. I mean, we had these huge ice storms. And, pipes froze and stuff happened, and we moved from there to California, and it was kind of like, okay, well, nothing happens here. honestly, it was all pretty flat line here. It got warm, it got cool, but nothing like there.
But it still gets cold there. I mean, nothing's really changed in the last...
Yeah, I mean, we got rid of all of our, wool sweaters. You didn't... I mean, you have to have some serious cold protection when you live in a place like that. You don't dare, get in your car without being prepared. Like, what if your car broke down and you had to go walk somewhere? You can't just go take off in your dress-up clothes and go somewhere. You've got to always be prepared for things. It's harder to live in those climates. It takes a lot of planning and a lot of consideration for the cold. Like, here, you're just going to get all sweaty, Right.
So this whole notion of dangerous, it's about values and it's very subjective, and our perceptions of risk are often very misguided.
Yeah, I think your monster thing is really appropriate because it is portrayed a wee bit like a monster. And then you have I got a thing this last week. The Biden administration report admits green energy subsidized more than fossil fuels. And I thought, that's not shocking. But I was kind of, I guess, I don't know if I was surprised by it, but the numbers were staggering. From 2016 to 2022, renewable energy sources received $83.8 billion in subsidies, while fossil fuels received $24.5 billion. You look at that, you think, let's see, who's going to innovate more? Who's going to be more in the forefront? Who are they going to try to make us buy more products from?
Exactly. I mean, particularly wind turbines, they aren't economical without massive subsidies. And especially the offshore, people are bailing on the offshore wind just because, the costs are so humongous and the subsidies just aren't sufficient. So wind turbines are just very uneconomical to build. Solar is cheaper. It's still not cheap, but it's definitely much cheaper than the wind turbines.
But like where they put them, they put all those solar farms in the Midwest and then a giant hailstorm comes.
Yeah. Oops.
Epic fail. Goodbye, solar panels.
This is one of the big contradictions.
Yeah.
So the reason we don't want global warming and we want to get rid of fossil fuels is allegedly so we can get rid of bad weather.
Okay. Yeah, right.
So then
it's
they
just
make
fundamentally
our energy
unserious.
Sources, wind and solar and even hydro that fluctuate with the weather. We have wind droughts and solar droughts. If you have a forest fire, you're not going to be getting any solar radiation. With the big fires in Canada, apparently in New York, it really knocked out the solar power quite a bit. So why do we want our power supply
To be all one
to
way.
To be vulnerable to extreme weather. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just crazy.
Yeah, none of that makes any sense when you delve into it. But the problem is it's almost like when the music's up too loud, it's really hard to think. It's a little bit like that now with the whole narrative of this, because you're just bludgeoned with it everywhere. And I'm sorry, we have to take one more quick break. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and we have done two shows with her, October 1st and October 8th of 2023. I hope you'll listen to them both. Super informative, gives you lots of information to speak with your, with the true believers in your life, maybe share it with them and might give them pause for thought. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps now. He's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
You'll never shine if you don't glow. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
And all that glitters is gold.
Only shooting stars break the mold. It's a cool place.
It's our guest, Dr. Judith Curry, right there in a nutshell.
Only all-star.
Only shooting stars break the mold. Yeah, you absolutely are an all-star in this field because, well, for starters, you tell the truth. That's kind of a biggie. And you do tell it in a way that is understandable. You know, a lot of times science can be confusing, which doesn't give us regular people many tools. So,
well, I mean,
thanks for catering to the regular people.
Well, you know, it took me a long time to figure out how to do that. I started it like around 2006 or so. I became very intrigued by the blogosphere, you know, which was a very big deal, you know, back around that time. And I started going around to a bunch of different blogs and commenting, you know, a range of blogs, from the alarmist blogs to the skeptical blogs, and just engaging with people. And, you know, I was invited to write some guest posts and whatever. And but that really helped me develop my communication skills and my ability to write to a very broad audience. And in 2010, I started my own blog, Climate Etc., judithcurry.com, where, you know, a big part of what I'm doing is try to communicate in a way that works for a broad audience. I'm talking about, you know, not the QAnon types, but, you know, people who have a sincere interest, maybe have a college degree, but a smart high school student should be able to understand it, too. You don't need to be an expert or a specialist to understand this. And what I found is that a lot of people who are educated in technical fields outside of climate science became very interested in this field and began applying their knowledge and their expertise to investigating things, and they would write guest posts on my blog. And so, you know, I was able to develop this little community, you know, with a broad range of expertise, and it provides a forum for people across the spectrum, so to speak, to come, discuss, debate, question, disagree, argue, do whatever.
It's just really important, because those of us who, I mean, have any common sense at all, you look at, just you listen to some of this stuff and you go, all right, that can't be real. You know that there's something haywire with it, but you don't necessarily have the scientific background to go after it. And you have managed to pull those things that the rest of us spot right away, and then say, "Well, this is what you're looking at. This is what you're looking at," and it's really helpful. You also have a part of one of your in chapter 11. You talk about the applications of the precautionary principle. Maybe in our last little bit here, would it be cool to go through a little bit of your risk management and your precautionary principle, because you include the COVID deal in there, and God knows we all got an education there.
Okay, well, again,
in skepticism, I should say.
Yeah, this goes back to 1992. Remember the preventing dangerous human-caused climate change?
Right.
And the precautionary principle was enshrined at the Rio Earth Summit maybe a year or two before, you know, that we should, we don't need to have full understanding, but we should prevent it anyways, just in case. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, which works fine for something simple. Like, what if somebody comes up with, okay, red dye number 2 looks like it causes cancer. Well, how sure are we? Well, we're not that sure. But what the heck? We don't need red dye number 2. Let's just use, you know, beets or something like that if we need the red color. So it was a simple problem. You can easily find a replacement. Well, what we're talking about in terms of CO2 emissions is that there's no simple, quick replacement for fossil fuels. And so this precautionary principle is like at the root of these targets, 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees. And it's a really bad match for a really complex problem like climate change or COVID. Swinging over to COVID for a minute, like when In that first month, like I started hearing about this, I guess in January, you know, what the heck is going on? And I was trying to, you know, garner any information that I could. And in the very early days, there was so much uncertainty. We knew that this was going to go global. We knew that people were going to die probably a lot. But we didn't know a heck of a lot else. So in case of, like, clear and present danger, you know, a short period of applying the precautionary principle until we can figure out what's going on made a certain amount of sense in March when they started lockdowns and preventing people from traveling and stuff like that.
Sure.
So that makes a certain amount of sense. But by the time April and May rolled around, we started to have a lot more information, like it was the elderly who were dying and, you know, things like that. There was still confusion about transmission modes, but we were starting to learn a lot. And by the time it got to be June, you know, we knew it was more transmitted through the air. We didn't have to keep wiping every single surface we touched. We started learning a lot, so we didn't need to be, and we knew it was the older people. And so keeping those lockdowns, keeping those mandates for, you know, even longer a year made no sense, and what we ended up with was a cure that was much worse than the disease in terms of very adverse impacts on children who weren't able to go to school, young children who weren't able to see anybody's face and their speaking, you know, was slowed down. Old people who couldn't have, you know, who died without being able to see their families, cancer patients who didn't get treated. There were so many adverse impacts of these lockdowns. So that's an example of precautionary principle gone haywire. You know, the precautionary principle, it's different than precaution. Okay, caution means you have to be careful of danger. Like, and we know that it's dangerous to cross the street, so we look both ways. So that's like a cautionary thing to do. Precaution is when there's scientific uncertainty. Okay, so climate change and pandemic qualify. And precaution, taking caution, even though we don't know everything, makes sense. But the precautionary principle is sort of at a whole different level. It's about really mandating a solution, a precaution, without any regard to anything else, you know, to other values. Well, people want their freedom. They want an easier life. They want economic development. They want, you know, all sorts of other things. They want to go outside. They want to travel. So that's the precautionary principle is sort of when the notion of precaution goes haywire. Again, it's suitable for tame problems like red dye number two, but not for climate change. And so at most, the precautionary principle tells us, you know, we have a problem that justifies some response. It doesn't tell us what the response should be or the magnitude of the response. So it's a complete mismatch to really complex societal problems like COVID and climate change. And so having the global policy of, you know, eliminating fossil fuel is another example of precautionary principle run amok. You know, it completely neglects that people need energy and want energy, and we're slowing down development in places like Africa. We're messing with our food supply. We're redirecting all the development funds into CO2 mitigation funds, so we're exacerbating poverty. We're slowing down a sort of industrialization and infrastructure because of steel and cement use CO2. We're messing with the food supply through worrying about cowparts and fertilizer from ammonia that requires fossil fuels. So we're doing all sorts of stupid things that are making us much worse off while we're not, you know, we're degrading our energy infrastructure. And to all this, we're not doing anything to the climate. I mean, we're not going to have any kind of a noticeable impact. You know, like in the 22nd or 23rd century, we might see a slowdown in the rate of sea level rise, but that's maybe about it. You know, so why are we doing this? Well, because it's become, you know, it's part of the UN agenda, and now, you know, the national politicians have chimed in.
The grant money is at an all-time high. The government cheese is coming out in blocks that are too large to carry.
So you've got the scientists on board, you've got the businesses on board, on and on.
Universities.
All, you know, supporting, you know, it's become lucrative and professionally useful.
And in what you're seeing out there, what would be, it's not going to be one thing maybe, but where does the failure tipping point actually kind of either slow the roll or turn this back around? Like how much of this has to not come true for them to maybe back away?
What I think is going to happen is that people are going to realize that wind and solar don't work, and they're going to turn to nuclear, which is a really good solution. I mean, it takes time, it costs money, but it's a really good solution. So I think people are just turning in that direction.
And the new forms of nuclear, you know, because a lot of people, hear that, they freak out that, oh, my God, it's super dangerous, Three Mile Island.
Well, they're doing really good research right now on fusion energy that has no byproduct, and there's no real downside to fusion.
But they can clean the nuclear now and not have big
stockpiles. They can reuse it.
So both?
Yeah, they can. They can reuse it. Yeah, the Generation 4 nuclear power is wonderful. The modular reactors and molten salt and all these new technologies are just wonderful.
What do you see with the fusion?
Fusion, you know, we'll see. I mean, in principle, it's wonderful, but in practice, it's pretty much nowhere. So I don't know how long it's going to take for fusion to be a viable power source. I really don't know. But it's not on the near-term horizon, that's for sure. Technology is the answer. And once we have good technologies in this whole political, good energy technologies in this whole political debate goes away. a lot of people made their career on this. You know, all these NGOs, these organizations, scientists, and companies even who have you know, bet the farm on this being a huge, crazy issue. They're going to be disappointed, you know, in 10 to 20 years when, you know, this is, oh, yeah, I remember when we used to care about that.
Yeah, kind of like we laugh about the 1970s with the, you know, with the global cooling. You know, it was the Ice Age was coming. That's what they told us.
Right.
Like, did you know that was stupid back then? I mean, were you looking at that going, oh, for God's sake, they're telling people this?
Yeah, well, the 70s, I was still a student, and I wasn't really, you know, I would see it in a odd magazine. Oh, whoa, that's cool. you know, we have a lot more to fear from ice and cold than we do from warming. So, you know, people, and the best antidote to whatever Mother Nature has in store for us is to develop wealth and reduce our vulnerability to extreme wealth, to extreme weather. I mean, if we have money, we can afford desalination plants. We can afford safe infrastructure. We can, you know, develop reservoirs for our water resources so we can better manage them. And, you know, we have endless energy and information systems and all sorts of data and artificial intelligence, which will keep us informed and safe. You know, what's not to like? But all that requires economic development, and energy is sort of the is what fuels economic development. So, I mean, this is what we should be focused on. But, you know, the money, you know, from World Bank and various UN organizations that used to go to economic development in Africa and other underdeveloped nations is all being redirected to CO2 mitigation.
Which is dumb.
And anything
we have yet run out of time again. The news is going to cut us off, Dr. Curry. We've been on with Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. We got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back. Oh, you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.